Sir, what's the universal time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Iraqi authorities said their troops have retaken nearly one-third of western Mosul in an offensive that began less than a month ago. U.S. Special Envoy to the Global Coalition to Counter the Islamic State, Brett McGurk, says insurgent fighters are trapped and those left in Mosul will die.
ISIS has now lost over 60% of the territory it once held here in Iraq and is losing more every day. In total, in Iraq and Syria, coalition-enabled operations, that means our coalition supporting local partners, including Iraqi security forces, have cleared 50,000 square kilometers of territory from ISIS.
Washington Institute for Near East Policy scholar James Jeffries said the news could hardly be better.
All of the roads have been cut off. The ISIS forces remaining have been surrounded. There are some reports that up to 60% of the western side of the city have been taken in the course of the day. So it's clear that we have got, despite all of the wringing of hands of people about the battle for West Mosul, that we have a huge victory coming.
One Iraqi commander said IS militants have lost fighting power and they have begun losing command and control. Al-Qaeda-linked group called Levant Liberation Committee has claimed responsibility for twin blasts near holy shrines that are frequented in the Syrian capital Damascus. 74 people died, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Hundreds of Somali soldiers have gone on strike, forcing businesses to close over unpaid salaries going back 15 months. Somalia's new president promised both to pay the soldiers and to crush the Al-Shabaab insurgency. This is VOA News. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has intensified his dispute with the European nations.
Benim bakanıma, dışişleri bakanıma, bunun yanında...
He says the EU will pay the price for not allowing Turkish ministers to campaign with Turks living there for an April referendum in Turkey. Meantime, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte barred Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu from flying into Rotterdam. Over the weekend, Dutch riot police clashed with thousands of Turkish government supporters in Rotterdam as they gathered outside the Turkish consulate to show their support for President Erdogan, who is trying to push through next month's referendum that would expand his powers. Britain's top minister for leaving the European Union, David Davis, has appealed to lawmakers not to limit the prime minister, invoking Article 50 ahead of a vote in the amended bill for the UK to exit the EU when it comes before the House of Commons later today.
What I don't want to do is take a simple bill which is designed to do nothing more than put the result of the referendum into law, as the Supreme Court told us to do. We waited for the Supreme Court to give us the detailed guidance on that. We're going to do that. Please don't tie the Prime Minister's hands in the process of doing that for things which we expect to attain anyway.
Davis said lawmakers should pass a bill authorizing exit talks without amendments so the government can enter EU negotiations. If the bill passes today, Prime Minister Theresa May could announce she is triggering Article 50 as early as Tuesday, Article 50 bringing about the negotiations. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson makes his first trip to Asia with stops Wednesday in Japan, Friday in Seoul, Saturday in Beijing. Among his objectives, how to deal with North Korea's nuclear missile threat. Anki Panda is an associate editor for the Asia-Pacific publication The Diplomat.
The North Korea policy review that the administration began in early February is still underway. My inclination will be to wait and see how this really pans out. I think Tillerson's trip could provide the administration with important data points about what precisely the Chinese, the South Koreans, and the Japanese are expecting from the United States.
Tillerson arrives in South Korea as he grapples with the aftermath of President Park Geun-hye's impeachment and removal from office, as well as the deployment of a U.S. anti-missile shield to protect the South from a North Korean attack. That system is opposed by China, who regards it as a national security threat. Washington insists that it is purely defensive. Get more on these stories and the rest of the hour's news at our website. Find us at voanews.com and, as always, on the VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, March 13th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A candidate in this year's Liberia presidential election says he's staying in the race despite a Supreme Court ruling that some say bars him and other candidates from contesting.
I'm not interested in any financial remuneration that comes to being government. I truly want to serve to change our country. And the most impactful way to change our country, to touch all 4.2 million people, is through the presidency.
Alexander Cummings is a presidential candidate for the Alternative National Congress Party of Liberia. A female peace activist says Burundian women who bear the brunt of the country's conflict should have a role in conflict resolution. And that March is National Dialogue Month in South Sudan, but the government has set conditions for others to participate.
As long as they continue to be called armed opposition and they have not denounced violence, then they don't deserve to even talk about this dialogue.
Michael Makui is South Sudan's information minister. A World Bank official will discuss boosting infrastructure development in Africa, and Somalis in Kenya fight stereotypes through film. Those stories for Samson Omale Sports, and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. One of the candidates in this year's Liberia presidential election says he's staying in the race despite the Supreme Court ruling that some say bars him and other candidates from contesting. The court ruled earlier this month that a code of conduct for public officials was constitutional. The code requires certain government officials seeking to run for elected offices to resign their posts 2 years before election and for others 3 years before. Alexander Cummings, presidential candidate for the Alternative National Congress Party, was appointed by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to serve on the board of directors of the Booker Washington Institute, Liberia's first vocational school. He says while he respects the court's ruling, it does not affect his candidacy.
The Superior Court in our country has ruled, and as a person and as a country that respects the rule of law, we have to abide by the ruling of our Supreme Court. And so while I know there's some debate as to the rationale for the court in the first place, should we be barring anybody from running for elective office, and should we let the Liberian people through their vote make that decision? That debate exists. The fact is the court has ruled. And I think we should respect the ruling of the court because they are the final arbiter of these kinds of decisions.
There's a talk that ruling affects your chances of running for president. Is that how you see it?
No, it does not. And we have checked every which way. I don't believe we're covered or barred in any way. You know, my aspiration was known. It was no secret when I was asked to serve on the BWI board. I made my aspirations known. It was public. I was going around on my familiarization tour. So there was no ambivalence about my intentions when I did that. And I am supporting BWI because I believe in vocational education. Because BWI was, and I believe still is, the premier vocational education institution in my country. And so my willingness to serve was pure in that regard. And again, my aspiration.
Not for the financial benefit.
There's no financial benefit. It is not a paying role. It's not a job. I don't go to work. Unfortunately, I've never been to any board meetings because I haven't had the time to do that. In fact, I've financially contributed to PWI by procuring a 350 kV generator for the school, a quite expensive generator. So no remuneration.
Mr. Cummings, is there a remedy? I mean, there's some people who say the court has ruled, as you just said. You say it does not impact you, is that right?
It does not impact.
So you intend to
run. So there's no action. Yeah, absolutely.
I just wanted to ask you, first of all, people see you as an outsider. So what do you think? What are your chances of winning an election in Liberia?
I think my chances are very good. I think being an outsider is actually a positive. And we're viewing it that way, and we're leveraging that way. And I think more and more Liberians are beginning to see us that way. We are untarnished by any of the challenges of our recent history, by war, by corruption, by any scandals, or any of those things. And so as a result, we offer a fresh perspective, a fresh face, new ideas, a different choice, an alternative choice.
Just briefly define for me your own mission. What's the reason for which you are running?
I believe I've been very blessed in life. First of all, blessed to be a Liberian, a very proud Liberian, blessed with lots of experiences, good family, and I feel an intense obligation to give back to the country of my birth, the country that made me who I am. And so I'm running to serve the Liberian people, to bring the experiences I've been blessed to have.
If I'm not mistaken, think about 21, 22 candidates. Do you see yourself pairing at some point with some other political parties?
I think coalitions make sense, and we're actively in conversations with other political parties about coalitions. I think that's something that should happen, needs to happen. And so we're open to conversations to coalesce. I'm not interested in being the vice president of Liberia. My aspiration is to be president of Liberia. And I don't say that in any arrogant fashion. I don't say that with any disrespect to the role of vice president. But if you understand what I'm trying to do, why I'm doing it, you'll understand why it's important that I believe I want to lead the country, to work with the Liberian people to set the agenda, to begin the transformation process. I'm not interested in being government just to be in government. I'm not interested in the trappings that come with being government. I'm not interested in any financial remuneration that comes with being government. I truly want to serve to change our country. And the most impactful way to change our country, to touch all 4.2 million people, is through the presidency.
Alexander Cummins is presidential candidate of the Alternative National Congress Party of Liberia. He spoke with me here in Washington, D.C. A female peace activist says Burundian women who bear the brunt of the country's conflict should have a role in resolving the conflict. Karine Kanessa, spokesperson for the Women and Girls Movement for Peace and Security of Burundi, was denied permission to speak at the United Nations last week. She says that she was informed later that Russia had exercised its veto power over her speech. Kanessa says Burundian women have the legal right to participate in any situation leading to the peaceful resolution of the conflict, including peace negotiations.
First of all, what happened is that I was officially invited by the United Kingdom mission to the United Nations, who was presiding the Security Council for the month of March. And at the last minute, I was informed that the Russian mission had basically exercised its right to veto my speech at the Security Council. I was inside the room. I mean, I was inside. I listened to all the speeches, and what I did was to record my presentation outside of the Security Council, and my speech was delivered to the members of the Security Council and distributed actually more widely than it would have been had I been allowed to address the Security Council itself.
Why do you suppose that happened with the Russians? What's their role? Do they have any part in what's happening in Burundi?
I wouldn't be able to respond to that. I think you have an element of international politics in there. Like in any situation, I think you always have competing interests and competing powers at play, even on very simple matters, like the voice of the civil society being allowed to speak to very important issues pertaining to their own countries. And then you have, obviously, in any protracted conflict like the one in Burundi, you tend to see irresponsible, negative alliances between the regime and other powers. So it could be either one or both of those situations at play.
I do follow what's happening in Burundi a lot, but I don't hear a lot about what women are doing. What's the role of women in Burundi, like your organization? What role are you playing, if at all, in what's going on, say negotiations and all that?
I think women have a multifaceted role to play. I think women, first of all, are the victims of conflicts like the one we see occurring in Burundi. Women are the victims, but at the same time, they are also the ones who will be picking up the pieces and participating in the reconstruction of the country. Let's remember what happened in the aftermath of the genocide in Rwanda or elsewhere. You will always see, because men go to war, men will be the ones fighting in the battlefield. You will see women literally, on one hand, they'll be the ones burying their husbands and their brothers and their sons. And on the other hand, they will have to learn very quickly to address different situations in their country. So we do have a very important role. Women, I think, throughout the history of the world, especially in Africa, women have been the advisors of kings, and they've been queens. So we have that in us, I think, historically speaking. And then today, thanks to different actions, advocacy actions from different organizations, we do have a resolution 1325, which was adopted by the United Nations. So we have the right. I think we've passed the de facto type of position we used to be in, and now we do have actually the legal right to participate in any situation leading to the peaceful resolution of these conflicts, including peace negotiations.
Karen Kanessa is the spokesperson for the Women and Girls Movement for Peace and Security in Burundi. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Today is Monday, March 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. This month is National Dialogue Month in South Sudan, but the government has set preconditions for the participation of the armed opposition and people in opposition-held areas of the country. Government spokesman Michael McQuay says people who took up arms and civilians living in rebel-held areas must first denounce violence before they are allowed to participate in the dialogue, which is slated to begin later this month. Tito Justin reports from Juba.
Information Minister Michael McQuay told reporters in Juba that all armed opposition groups trying to overthrow President Salva Kiir's government will not be allowed to take part in the initiative Mr. Kiir announced in December.
As long as they continue to be called armed opposition and they have not denounced violence, then they don't deserve to even talk about this dialogue, because originally they don't accept whatever is done by the government. These are the people who are demanding that this government must go. These are the people who are saying this government must be taken over and South Sudan must be turned into a protectorate.
McQuay says the purpose of the national dialogue is to identify issues affecting the country and come up with amicable solutions. He says the national dialogue will be implemented in a bottom-up approach, meaning it will start from the grassroots level. He says the government will pursue an armed group if it continues to fight the Kiir administration.
These people, if they don't accept to come and sit and denounce violence, then definitely we will fight. And if they accept to denounce violence, put down their arms and denounce violence, we'll be ready to sit with them on the table, dialogue as South Sudanese, so that we resolve our problems.
The international community, local activists and opposition politicians have been calling on the government to make the national dialogue inclusive. Otherwise, they say it is nothing more than a monologue. Asked how the government will make the process inclusive when it has set preconditions, McQuay had this to say.
Yes, it shall be inclusive, but this is how we see the inclusivity. Inclusivity does not mean bringing in anybody who is anti-South Sudanese, somebody who is anti-peace, somebody who is anti-everything.
Asked whether the process will succeed if it's spearheaded by President Kiir, who some say is a big part of the problem, McQuay says the president has a right to lead the national dialogue as the legitimately elected head of the country. He dismisses concerns that the dialogue will not succeed so long as it is headed by Mr. Kiir.
What is wrong with the government facilitating such a process? Since the initiative came from it, it has to facilitate it and leave the rest of the work for these bodies to do it. So there is no way whereby you can say this should be spearheaded by neutrals.
McQuay describes the national dialogue as a continuation of the implementation of the agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan. Critics say the 2015 peace deal is a failure as both sides violated the agreement within days of being signed. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The executive director of the World Bank Group 1 constituency, Andrew Vumme, says the International Development Association has received $75 billion for boosting various projects in Africa and other parts of the world. Vumme said part of this amount, $45 billion, will be set aside for African nations. Vumme, who is a Zimbabwean, says the amount is aimed at boosting infrastructure, agriculture, and mining.
Well, since I started my assignment in November, I think I can say I'm well settled, and we are on our way to implement my agenda. And really, one of my key objectives was to raise resources for the countries I represent. And I want to say that we have just been successful in terms of our IDA 18 replenishment, where we have raised over $75 billion for IDA poor countries, and of that, about $45 billion is going to come to Africa. So this, for me, is a huge success during my first 3 months of the term.
Mr. Vumbe, how big is your constituency, and which countries in Africa fall under it?
I have 22 countries in my constituency, ranging from Botswana, Burundi, Lesotho, Swaziland, Namibia, and also Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda. Up north, you go to Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, and then on the other side, I've got the Gambia, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. So it's quite a huge and varied composition of countries.
What issues would you like to address during your tenure?
One of the key issues we want to address, which is a huge challenge, is on the infrastructure. I think the issue of energy is very important for my constituents. Without energy, we cannot develop. So even the transformation we are talking about, without energy, we cannot move forward. So that's one area. Infrastructure development is going to be very key. The second area we feel is agriculture and agribusiness, because our countries have been exporting raw materials, commodities, and other mineral commodities. But now what we want is to move away and add value to these. So for agriculture, it's going to be important for us to have agribusiness value chains, and also in the mining sector. So those are two areas which are going to be very important. Besides that, also on the social sector, we need to look at education and also issues relating to health. I think those are some of the areas we want to focus on.
Narrowing down on Zimbabwe, you being a Zimbabwean yourself, what are your plans for this year for Zimbabwe?
Well, as you are aware, Zimbabwe has got a huge debt overhang, and also we have got arrears to the World Bank and to the African Development Bank. And one of our priorities is to normalize the relations between Zimbabwe and the IMF, World Bank, and the African Development Bank. As you might be aware, we have cleared the arrears at the IMF. Now we are working towards clearing the arrears with the World Bank and the African Development Bank. This is our priority programming this year.
Andrew Vume is executive director of the World Bank Group 1 constituency. He was speaking with reporter Marvelous Nyahuye of VOA Studio 7 program for Zimbabwe. You've heard of Hollywood, Bollywood, and Nollywood, but have you heard of Islewood? Islewood is the primarily Somali district of Nairobi, known to some as Little Mogadishu. A group of young people there has been making films to counter stereotypes and radicalization. Rael Ombuo has the story from Nairobi.
Very good. Okay. This is Islewood. Actors are working on a scene for the group's next movie. They have also produced a TV series, several documentaries, and two feature films, including Lanners. This film tells the story of a young man who joins a criminal gang and sees his life spiral downwards. He ends up filled with regrets. The Isili part of Nairobi is home to many Somalis. As Al-Shabaab attacks spread to Kenya, Isili became the target of regular police raids. Isili residents experience discrimination and isolation.
We sent the Kenyan Defense Force to Somalia, and politicians trying to disseminate a lot of hate speech, trying to fight for the community. So we came out and say, okay, let's use audiovisual as platform to tell our true story.
Borhan Iman founded Isiliwood in 2011. The same year, Kenya sent its first troop to Somalia. The films show the diversity of the Isili area. The goal is to change people's impression of the Somali community in Kenya and guide local youth, says trainer Abdi Hakim Bare Hassan.
You know, we are living in a time that there are a lot of problems that are facing the youth. Radicalization, drug abuse, crime, such things. So what we do is that we train them so that they can apply what we taught them here in the market, so they at least get busy.
Isiliwood does not shy away from sensitive topics. Their next film tackles the issue of domestic violence. Hassan Rizak always wanted to be an actor. He left his Somali hometown of Kismayo as a child.
I started educating myself whether it's going to primary, secondary, then college. And what I used to like mostly, to be an actor. Then, before I joined Islewood, and there was no company which is around in Somali community or in Isle.
Now, 6 years into the project, Islewood continues to find inspiration on these city streets. Rael Ombuo for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin from Zambia, where the final of the 2017 Under-20 African Cup of Nations was played on Sunday. Hosts the Junior Chipolopolo of Zambia became champions of the 2017 Under-20 African Cup of Nations after they defeated Senegal 2-0 in the final on Sunday. It was Zambia's first appearance in the Under-20 AFCON final, while it was back-to-back final defeats for Senegal following their 1-0 loss to the Flying Eagles of Nigeria in the 2015 edition, which they hosted. I spoke with an excited Bestin Chambeshi, head coach of the young Chipolopolo of Zambia, on the secret behind their success.
Yeah, I feel great, and it has been it's nice to win the AFCON. Yeah, I'm very happy to achieve this trophy.
Coach, what was the secret behind your success at the African Cup of Nations for Under-20?
No, it's about the preparation. At least we had a good preparation. You know, we went to Spain. We had to spend 10 days in Spain, and the boys trained very well. We had the nice facilities in Spain. And we are happy with the sponsorship we are getting from the government. They really helped us to prepare very well for the tournament.
Early on Sunday, Guinea defeated the Amajita of South Africa 1-0 to finish third and to win the bronze medal. Both Guinea and South Africa, alongside the 2017 AFCON Under-20 finalists Zambia and Senegal, will represent Africa at this year's FIFA Under-20 World Cup in South Korea. Now to the CAF Champions League, where several matches were played at the weekend in the first leg round of 32 games. Egyptian giants Zamalek fought their way to an epic 4-1 win over Enugu Rangers of Nigeria, while another Nigerian side, Rivers United, cruised to a 3-0 win over Sudanese club El Merik at the Yakubu Gowon Stadium in Port Harcourt. Coach of Nigeria's Rivers United, Stanley Iguma, said the win is a good cushion for them ahead of their second leg game.
I think it wasn't a bad one for us. We take it gradually. The most important thing is that we're able to win today.
Kelechi Osunwa of El Merik of Sudan blamed their loss to fatigue.
All the players are all tired because of in the past month we're playing like every 3 days. We're playing the Arab Champions League, we're playing the league, and we're playing the African Champions League as well. We just had 8 games this month, so I think all the players are fatigued.
Elsewhere, Ferroviario Beira of Mozambique managed a 2-0 win over Barak Young Controllers FC of Liberia. My colleague James Botti spoke with coach Cooper Sana of the Barak Young Controllers, who says despite their loss in the first leg, he's looking forward to the second leg in Monrovia.
This is the preliminary round for the group stage, the last stage for the preliminary round to qualify us for the group stage. Sunday will be the return leg in Liberia, specifically in Monrovia.
Should we expect that your team is going to put up a very good fight?
Yeah, we are optimistic with the level of support we've been getting from our management and our own player interaction with the enthusiasm. We are optimistic of winning home, not only winning, but qualifying to the group stage.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports for this Monday morning. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. One of the candidates in this year's Liberia presidential election says he's staying in the race despite a Supreme Court ruling that some say bars him and other candidates from contesting. Alexander Kamis says while he respects the court's ruling, it does not impact his candidacy. And that's it for this Monday, March 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson Omale, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Tuesday on Health Chat, join host Lenore Modu, reassessing your health stress in 2017 with Ken Red Cross, internal medicine and concierge doctor. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.